You're listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form Laurent, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast from New York City. I'm Caitlin Puckett. I was the guest on the last episode, but today I'm the host. And my guest today is Alexis Pereira, who improv fans might know from a list of 50 different things. My God, what a resume. He's on the Herald team Mr. Crime and currently Some Kid. He's also a part of 50... Cinquenta? Did I say that?
That is as close as you'll get it.
Living room first generation writer for Bright and Murdery Heights, Dr. Brothers. Yeah. What did I miss?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't a writer on Bright and Murdery Heights, or I was an actor. Yeah, I was an actor.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You're a triple threat. You do all three.
You know, I write, I act, and I show up on time. So that's my three threats.
Honestly, showing up on time is huge and rare.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not a lot of people can say that.
Especially in this city with this MTA.
Let's dive into it. When did you first get started with improv?
It's a mix of things. I would say that I've been going to UCB since around 2001 and seeing shows and like just loving improv and loving sketch and just watching shows. But then I started taking classes, I would say 2007, like September 2007.
Okay. Did you do any kind of performing before UCB?
Yeah, I was in the high school theater group, you know, college theater. We did short form in college a little bit.
Oh, cool.
But yeah. I just wrote a lot in college and performed there. And even did some stand-up in college at St. John's University.
Now, I think it's so interesting when people do both a lot of writing and a lot of improv. I could see them helping one another out. Were you a writer before really getting into improv?
Yeah, I think that I wanted to do a lot of sketch, and I even started a sketch group that performed in the city a little bit, and I think that I just loved improv, but I was kind of like, I may not do that. But then I started taking classes after seeing, I come back to UCB and seeing a couple shows where I was like, wow, this, like I really like this, and I really want to do this now, more so than ever. I think that generally I would say the improv from back in the day was really hit or miss, even from the really people who we think are really great. You know, I think there were a lot of people just figuring it out. A lot of, you know, the classes were so small and stuff like that, I'm sure back in the day, that like around the city. So, you know, you just see like improv where you're like, all right, that's all right. And then, you know, I would say around 2006, 2007, I was like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. And I just wanted to take classes and start doing it.
Do you remember a particular show?
Yeah. Two? Yeah. I came back, you know, I'm from New York City, I would go to UCB quite regularly. But then, like for like a couple years, I stopped going, or really just maybe I came back just for like a sketch show and you know not much improv. And then I came back for a cage match, which a friend of a friend was in against this team called Hot Sauce, and I was my friend of a friend was pretty good, you know, just exactly as I remember improv always being. And then Hot Sauce with Ben Schwartz and Adam Pally, they came out and they just did unbelievable improv. And you know, I don't think at the end of the day, I don't think anybody can really do what they do. You know, it's just insane. You know, really funny improv. But I was like, this is incredible. This is stuff I kind of want to do one day. So I started taking classes after that.
As of now, do you have a preference between the two?
Between sketch and improv?
Yeah.
You know, I like both for very different reasons. I kind of consider sketch like this kind of battle plan. You know, you kind of sit down, you sketch out how you want to attack the show, and you know, you go through all the, you go through how, like, how each sketch is going to hit. You know, like, this sketch will go last, this sketch will go first, and this, and like, there's a reasons why you do all that. And I even directed sketch. I directed a couple of mod teams here at UCB, and I really love that. Like, I just love, like, sitting down with people and planning things out. And then improv is different because I love that it's kind of, it checks in with where your head is at about a lot of different things.
That's a really interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. I completely agree.
And you know, it's it. I've been lucky enough to be able to perform a lot and get better in New York, but I feel like the more I perform, I kind of, you know, when you take on a character in the moment, then I'm almost like wow, this is what I think about this kind of situation right now at this moment. Like, this is how I feel. It's just a nice way to keep checking in. I don't know.
Yeah. When you were first taking improv classes, did you find that the sketch either like helped or hurt you in some ways?
Yeah, it hurt. This is probably just very personal to me because I never took sketch at UCB, which is another issue.
Oh.
But I wrote sketch, like, and I taught myself, and then I got like a lot of opportunities to put up sketches that I wrote, like, around New York, and you know, I had a sketch team that was performing regularly at Stand Up New York. And I noticed that what happens is when you write a lot and then you take sketch, then you take improv, is you start planning a lot.
Yeah, and, I could see that.
Yeah, and you also make big choices that, and maybe this is just personal as well, that a lot of people, your team isn't ready for, you know, you're not doing group mind as well as you should. So there are times even where I kind of get back to my sketch mindset where I'm like, you know what, this scene needs this. And then, you know, it's not a natural move for everybody.
Yeah.
So that can be an issue. And especially early on, I would not be playing, you know, off the cuff. I was a little reserved player and a little slower pace. And, you know, it held me back. I think that's just personal. I think there are people who can write sketch and do improv just excellently, you know, no matter what. I was just kind of like, I would often find myself thinking about the scene.
Yeah.
In terms of structure, instead of just like being in the moment.
I think a lot of people do find themselves in that same headspace when they're starting out of pre-planning.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you found that really helped?
So I do work with players when I coach that, you know, I feel like have my same issue. And I basically just try to get them to think in the moment of like I'll give you an example. Like I do seven things, you know, as an exercise.
Ooh,
you know,
I love seven things, yeah.
But I'm very specific about how I want to see it. And I'm always like, okay, you have to give people a situation and a character, and they need to give you seven lines that they would say in that situation as that character. And it has to be pretty close to what you'd see in a scene. So I would say, okay, you know, you're a firefighter who's the pole, this is a terrible example, but like a firefighter who can't get downstairs because the pole's gone. You know, seven things that he'd say, you know. And it's like, I guess that fire is going to burn, you know. So it's, and I feel like that's weirdly a great way to get like thinky players into thinking into not planning and just getting into how they would react in situations and come up with natural games like that.
I love that. I'm gonna steal that.
Yeah,
exercise.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Really good.
Mm-hmm.
Here's one I want to mm-hmm. ask. What's one thing you wish the entire improv community could do? Like, if you could say, hey, everyone, do this now.
Yeah, okay, that's great.
Do this habit.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. I think just going to myself, I would say that the number one thing you need to realize is that nobody is going to change you. No coach or teacher is going to change you. They'll maybe move you in a direction. And honestly, they know. So every coach and teacher knows way more about you than they'll be able to explain to you. Okay, so that's the first thing. So I think everybody needs to realize that. But what you need to do is there needs to be an internal coach, an internal teacher they're guiding you towards that direction as well. And I think somebody said that, like, that a lot of players almost want abuse, you know, from, like, their teachers. Like, tell me what I'm doing wrong. I want hard notes, you know. And, like, I feel like that's almost like a hole in the ozone layer in your head there. You know, you can't just, like, let... Because if you're just like, give me hard notes, those hard notes will go as soon as they come in, you know? So
It just puts you in that headspace to be critical instead of being present.
Exactly. So I would say that in general, what I'd love to see is players who are you know, be self-critical and be very open to all notes and criticisms, but, you know, don't seek out to be criticized in a weird way. Just try to get better, and be, I don't know, some kind of like weird, like self-sufficient entrepreneur on being a better improviser, instead of like trying to seek out people who are going to change you, because really nobody can change you but yourself, especially in improv.
I think that's fantastic advice, and people, millions of you listening out there, follow that now.
Yeah. But you know, in general, though, again, you always need that person who's like kind of guiding everybody and being in charge. So you still need coaching and teaching, and, you know, go ahead and seek out people who are, you think are better. But again, they can only bring you so far.
Exactly. Mm. I think, like, I remember as a student waiting for kind of like a magical note that would just make me click and I would be a great improviser. Mm. And that doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't really exist. And it weirdly, it's just the habit of being more open is what eventually makes you a better improviser, like being more fluid with, like, you know, if somebody gives you notes, but also still holding on to your personality and to your point of view. So it's like a mix. Yeah. That's like kind of what makes a great improviser.
Very true. Oh, this is good. This is nerdy stuff. I love it.
Yeah.
What kind of improv do you like doing? Are you more premise? Are you more organic?
Yeah, I would say, yeah, I love premise 100%. I just love stepping off the back line with like a hard game to play. I would say that I at times lean so hard in that direction where I'm just like, you know, when I see like, because we do Living Room First Generation, which is a show came up with Maritza and Adrian. And what it is we tell stories about growing up as first generation Americans, and then we improvise based off of that, right?
Yeah.
And that uses a form called the premise keepers. And premise keepers is basically just people telling stories generally, and then all of a sudden somebody initiates. That's how we run Living Room. And I think that the reason why we came up with it is, you know, it's just so, the understanding of how to come up with a premise, which is like, you know, half a game, is a hard skill, but it is very true and honest to what was being presented, you know. Whereas in a more organic opening, anything can happen. You know, if with a sound of movement I don't know what the other one is, sound of movement, and then what's the other one that's kind of like that? Is it the organic? I don't know.
Like flocking, or
yeah, something like that. Sound of movement. There's no words. I believe that's the idea. And then there's another one where it's just kind of like anything goes in the opening.
Oh right, yeah.
And with those openings and openings like that, where you know, another example of a more organic style opening is like scene painting, where you're just kind of seeing something and learning about a room. But then again, anything can be initiated, and that'd be great, you know, as long as it's a strong opening. But with premise keepers, and Living Room, I'm just like, okay, these stories are so great, we need initiations that are going to be true to the stories, so we can see them played out by improvisers. And I'm just like a fan of that.
Do you have a favorite scene that comes to mind from that?
Well, yeah, I would say that Millie talked about how she did it when her parents would buy her like romance novels when she was in fourth grade, because they didn't know what they were. You know, they were just kind of like, hey, we found you books, you know, and she would be like reading them. So we initiated a scene where somebody was doing a book report to their fourth grade class on a romance novel. It was really fun. And like it's funny because like the person doing it, it was Louis doing it, like he was just like,
oh god, yeah,
he was talking about like, you know, there's a passion, they had a passion for each other, and then he would say something like, but then he touched their boobs, and then like the whole class just erupts like, oh my god, he said boobs. Yeah, no, it was really fun. I think there are improvisers out there again who are kind of like, I like premise better. I wish the openings had more clear games. And then others are like, I like freedom, you know. And I've coached players who like, you know, will do an opening and they just don't do anything from the opening. And they're like, yeah, but I just like being more free and I like improvising. And then I coach players who are like, I need this opening to be more clear, you know. And I'm just like, okay, you can have a preference, but you know, you will be literally naked on stage if you don't get both good at both.
Yeah, yeah. I'm definitely more of an organic, but there is something very comforting about like having a premise ready.
I think I'm a more premise player, but I think players who are better at just being who like that kind of organic style improv where are more useful in almost every improv show, because you can just put them on stage and if somebody initiates with a premise, they're ready to go. If they initiate, they can then they can initiate with a premise and then and make it work. So both they're more useful to almost every improv team. I think these players who are who generally are better at initiating with a specific premise that comes off the opening and it's like airtight and like the audience like immediately just like laughs for a minute because they're just like, oh, what a pull, you know. I think that, you know, those are great and those are moments are really great, but then there are times where I see these players and they're just and I'm talking about myself sometimes where you just kind of like naked in a scene where that doesn't know what's going on because they're just like there's no track for them, whereas players who are kind of like, you know, who are better like at this kind of organic style improv, it's just like what they're teaching at the school. It's like you build the plane as you fly it, you know.
Yeah.
that's the point, you know. If you want to, I think it was Ian Roberts who was like, if you just want to think about premises all day and come up with like specific funny premises, quit improv right now and start writing sketch and you will be a writer in no time on a TV show and go be rich and famous or whatever you want to do. But like, don't try to throw your premises on other people. Just like the reason why, you know, improv teams go up there, why it's a team and why it's, you know, not like it's not like a company, is because everybody's up there for group mind and everybody has to add to the show. You can't just be like, all right, this is what I'm going to do and everybody else is going to do their thing.
Yeah. Would you say Premise Keepers is your favorite type of opening?
Yeah, no, because I think that what happens is it can be a little talky and a little vague. So if I see Premise Keepers just being done without like, you know, is an example, like our show is just literally about all our premises are about growing up as first generation Americans. So the audience is kind of engaged in a way because they either are first generation Americans themselves laughing at stories that they you know identify with, or they are you know people who are not and are interested. It's interesting. It's engaging to everybody. But I often find that with like this kind of general Premise Keepers or even like the sometimes the monologue openings, you know, I think this like called Near Mondo, that there are times where you like tell stories where nobody cares, you know. and your team members are standing around and they're kind of like wondering where things are going. So you're just kind of like, oh, this is an interesting story. You're literally saying this is going to be funny, you know. Whereas with the show, again, I'm talking about my show so much, but like with mine, it's kind of like you're saying literally, this is a story about growing up first generation American. I don't know if it's going to be funny, you know. I hope it's interesting. But whereas like when I see like openings where somebody steps out and just talks for a while, they're like, okay, I'm going to have to make you laugh with this story, and it's going to have to also have game in it, and it's going to also have to have a lot of interesting details for you to pull, you know. It's not as interesting to me. My interest is with openings is, you know, I think that it's a mix of people coming up with interesting premises, but building it as a team.
Yeah.
Because that, to me, the more people you have on board when you reach a premise, the easier it will be when you initiate. You know, if you like if somebody tells a story by themselves for 10 minutes and then everybody just takes shots at initiating, you're going to get a lot of, you know, again, good players can go out there and do whatever, but like you're going to get a lot of people wondering where you're headed with this, you know, unless you are like a very capable player. Whereas, you know, I would say like my favorite openings, pattern game is my favorite, 100%. I love
it.
Yeah. I love a pattern game. My preference is a pattern game style that I don't really see very often, where players kind of go out and within the millisecond give the next word or the line or the premise, and just kind of keep going. You don't stop. You don't go back to the clover or whatever that is. You don't go back to the word. You just keep going and keep exploring, because that first of all, there's a couple of things going on there. One is there's a negation where when people go, like let's say the initiation is frog, or the suggestion is frog rather, mm-hmm. and then we get a couple, and then somebody goes, you know, somebody throws up a high jump. Instead of taking that and going high jump, Olympics, you know, they'll go mm-hmm. frog. They'll go back to the word again, and then everybody kind of like claps, and it's like a weird moment, like
yeah,
when people
like,
go back to that an original word.
Like, oh, are we going to use that?
Yeah. So, and again, that's useful too because it gives players kind of. You know, it gives players a track, and I think for newer players, that kind of three clover pattern game is, mm-hmm. is useful. And also, but there are times where I see it and I go, okay, people are thinking too much. You know, there's too much silence. Whereas my preference would be everybody just kind of like just being engaged with each other and just going as fast as we can. So it's just like frog, jump, Olympics, Olympian who is scared of a high jump. I don't want to do it, coach. Well, you trained for 3 years. I don't want to do it. High bar. You know, just keep going. Don't let any silence creep in there because once again, it's the opening is the you know table of contents for the show in a way.
Yeah.
So if there's silence in the opening, more often than not, there's going to be silence in the rest of the show, and you don't want that. You don't want too much thinking to creep up because that's where judgment comes in. That's where balls get dropped. You know, let's see if we can do openings where people are aggressive and polite and listen and come up with premises and establish a rhythm, and then let's see if we can carry that rhythm throughout the rest of the show.
Yeah.
I also like the doc opening because, and generally. My preference for the doc opening is kind of like a baton pass, or at least that's what I call it. I think somebody should step out, sit down, and then start talking, and kind of they need to like it, everything is we, everything needs to be matched. I don't like it's like this is my wife and she doesn't blah blah blah, because again you're starting out with negation, you're starting out with
right.
two people in conflict, and you don't want conflict in the opening. That's another thing you don't want.
That's killer.
Yeah. So my preference is somebody sits down and just starts talking, and as soon as the partner feels comfortable, they just take that baton and start continuing it. So it's just like, you know, we're farmers and we were planning for another Dust Bowl, and unfortunately, the weather's been way too nice. We kept way too many crops, and then like I want this first person to not stop, which I see a lot, and go and just like look at their partner and be like, okay, your turn. That's terrible, you know.
Yeah.
I think that you want to keep talking, give your partner time to step in and comfortably put on that skin, and then after that. You can stop whenever you want because both people are on board with that opening. Again, it's about getting out of your. Another thing is opening is like it's getting off. You got to have your stiff clothes and just loosening up, and it's mm-hmm. basically a warm up for the rest of the show as well.
Yeah, it is. It really does set, like if you have a really low energy, like a bad pattern game, it's just toxic for a set. You
yes.
have a weird mood before you even start doing scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What opening do you use for some kid?
So we do a character painting opening where it's kind of a character game pattern game, character painting pattern game, where we we first start pitching around ideas. You know, what was one recently? It's like, somebody said loaded, getting drunk at a party. Somebody who only goes to parties to get drunk. Somebody who goes to parties and it doesn't really care about what's going on at the party. And then somebody steps out and does like a 10-second monologue based on that character. Like for that one, I stepped out and I was like, well, first of all, happy birthday to your niece. It's her sweet what? her sweet 16. Wow, well, she looks sweet at any age. Where's the, you know, some. Yeah, and also be true to yourself as well.
Yeah, yeah, really pull from what you feel.
Yeah. So we do that, and then we step out as those characters in the show, and we try to be as true to the opening as possible.
Let's talk about your improv journey a little bit. Mm-hmm. Did auditions work the same way? How long did it take for you to get?
So I started taking classes regularly in 2007, and then auditions were, maybe I wasn't too familiar with it until I got to advanced study. Mm-hmm. And I think they were once a year, and there was no, you know, Lloyd Knight. I don't know if people listening understand it. And there was just Harold Knight, and it was 8 Harold teams. And I think auditions were once a year, or they would just put people on. My first audition, I did not even pass to advanced study, I don't think. I think anybody could audition if they got through 401.
You had to audition for advanced study?
Oh, no. Anybody could audition if you took 401, I think. I'm pretty sure. You didn't have to get into advanced study to audition. Oh. I don't know if that's the way it is now.
Yeah, you have to be approved for advanced study.
Okay, so I think, yeah, you took 401 once. Oh, yeah, it definitely was, because I failed 401. And I failed 401, and then I auditioned. I failed 401 first, and I skipped an audition. And then I auditioned. I just can't remember if I passed it yet. But then I auditioned next time, and my first time didn't do well at all. And then the next one, I was just like, yeah, I'm getting on. I was extremely confident I was getting on, and I got on. So I think I just auditioned twice in 3 years after taking classes for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. And your first team was Mr. Crime?
Yeah, it was Mr. Crime. It was all first time. Yeah, only 10 people got on that year, and 2 people were added to like veteran teams, and they made 1 all-new team that year, and it was Mr. Crime. Yeah.
What was your experience like on Mr. Crime?
You know, I think it was I think everybody would agree it was pretty hectic. We were a new team, and there's a lot of things about being a new team and being new to the house system that take a little while to feel comfortable with.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I think in general, I don't know if this is just me in general, but I feel very comfortable. You know, at UCB, you know, but I think it's really because I've been performing regularly now for 4 or 5 years. Whereas when I first got on as a house player, I had never even been in a show at UCB ever. You know, I just, except for the grad shows, and I didn't know anybody. So
really?
you just kind of know your team, and then there are times where you just kind of feel like, oh, wow, it's like us against the world. You know, so we were just desperately trying to get good and get better. And I think that kind of like weird, like competitiveness and like the yeah. shock of getting on and being like, wow, everybody here is out for these kind of finite spots, kind of dragged us down and unfortunately like didn't help us play at the top of our intelligence. Or, you know, I think like almost every show it was like, We did 2 rehearsals a week where we got like really hard notes, and then we would just kind of.
You had to do 2 practices a week?
Our thing was just like, we're really bad. We would just constantly tell each other, we're very bad and we got to get good. So we were just like, we got to rehearse twice a week and we got to. And, you know, and then eventually, you know, people just start turning on each other and all that stuff happens.
Oh,
I don't know what if that happens anymore because of Lloyd Knight or whatever, but. It was just kind of it was like just constantly a high pressure situation constantly.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, this entire team was just under a high pressure situation.
If you could like go back to that situation, is there anything you would have done differently to have made it less stressful?
Yeah. I think the number one thing is I would cut the second practice of the week.
Really?
Yeah. And also I would say, you know, I don't know if this is possible with people who are on their first Harold teams and it's the first time on a house team. Just kind of tell everybody that, like, you know, play as yourself. So go up there and play as yourself and everybody will learn. I think everybody was trying to play as somebody who was not like themselves at all, because everybody was like, I need this type of player to play with and I need this type of player to play with. So everybody's like, okay, I'll try to be that player. I'll try to be this player. And so, but what happens is you just start, you're playing a character in situations like that. You're just like, all right, if I was this improviser, what would I do? You know? Whereas I think if everybody just kind of like chilled, didn't think it was like the end of the world, kind of like played as themselves, I think they'd be way better for it. Even if we struggled yeah. early on, which is funny, because early on we were not too bad because we were like just so desperate, but we're just kind of like, we're still not good enough. We got to be better. And then the whole thing fell apart.
Go by textbook. Yeah. I think that's fantastic advice. One I could definitely follow.
Yeah. It's now, you know, again, I think like, it was, everybody's very nice. It's nothing like about anybody in particular. It's just kind of like all of a sudden we just kind of, I don't know, we were like on an island, you know, like stranded on an island, and then we just turn on each other like any people stranded on an island ever do.
Do you think it was because your team felt like you had work to do, like there just wasn't playfulness a part of it?
Yeah, there was no playfulness, 100%. Then in fact, like in a weird way, there were times where it's like stop playing around, stop messing around, guys, like this is work, you know, we have to be very serious up there.
Yeah.
So I think that what just happens is, like, you know, when people are struggling, they get too serious, and that's what happened, you know?
I have a two-parter for you.
Mm-hmm.
What is your favorite team you've been on, and second part, why do you think the reason was most successful?
Yeah, sure. I was on an indie team called Boy Butter.
Oh, yes.
for a little bit, and it's a really great team. And I think that there were, what made it more successful? Was that your question? Well, I think that first of all, the construct of the team is a lot of people who have a very similar attitudes towards improv and comedy in general. I think that everybody on the team kind of has like a similar sense of humor, and that's something that you need to seek out, you know, like at different, you know, whatever theater you're at. You know, there are times where you're just like, oh, I really like the way that player plays or stuff like that. But sometimes that, like, there are players who are very powerful on stage, but
yes,
they just don't have the similar sense of humor, so you'll struggle with them forever, you know? And again, it's until you become like a really, really capable player, it's like really hard to learn when you playing with people who just kind of have different attitudes towards comedy. So we luckily all had similar ideas on comedy, there was like four or five of us at first, and then we started adding people who were like, this person plays like us, this person plays like us. And we eventually kind of got to a place where it was like, oh, like we are all like really funny, we believe in each other. I would say the second part about it is we took big risks.
Yeah.
But because we all appreciated the risks, we were very happy with it. You know, it would be like somebody would take a big risk in a show that would completely open it up. And in a team that's struggling, when somebody does that, the first instinct is, well, you just messed up what we were putting together.
You know?
So everybody, you know, whether or not it's a good move, everybody's like going to like backstage, they're going to be like, yeah, well, that scene, be sarcastic. They'll do that same like, well, that scene was going pretty well until Tom pulled the rug out on everybody, you know, and stuff like that. And you know, maybe both people are at fault. But
yeah,
that when people are kind of like annoyed with each other, especially like people as sensitive and also kind of like sensitive and yet determined as an improvisers typically are. They're just kind of like, well, you know, I'm hurt and you're going to know about it one way or the other. But
usually through bits,
yeah.
I find, which
yeah.
are the most uncomfortable to be around.
Yeah, no, of course. It's kind of like they want to slide the note under the door, you know, as
yeah.
opposed to... But I've been in situations where people have sat down and, like, literally said to each other what they had problems with. That wasn't fun either. So...
Do you think there's one that works better?
Again, I think that what happens is if people don't share a sense of humor, you know, yeah. you kind of need to move on. You know, I hate to say it. Even if you're on a team or you're like, this team is so good. We have a Tuesday night slot at Chucky's every other blue moon. And you're just like, but I don't have fun because I don't share the same sense of humor with my team.
Yeah.
You know, unfortunately, you'll have to move on. You know, I don't know about house teams. At house teams, like, it's a much more political and much more
right.
Sensitive situation. So you can't just be like, you know, I'm leaving this team and then, you know, ruin your career and you're not in SNL. But
exactly.
that's how it works. But if you're on indie teams and you're just kind of like, you know, this team isn't working out for me, I think there needs to be more dating in the improv scene. I think people need to kind of like, you know, I tried out this team and, you know, guys, like just break up with them just like you break up with anybody else. Guys, I'm a little busy right now. I'd like to concentrate on myself. And then join another team the next day and let them hate on you. Then, oh, that's fine.
I think that's good to put out there because, I mean, you do hear about someone being asked to leave a team and it's such a big deal.
Like, mm-hmm.
And it should be a little more accepted. Like, if you don't gel,
yeah.
you don't gel.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think the problem is that people, I mean, getting broken up with sucks no matter what it is. So, I mean, that's such a horrible situation if somebody's just like, you know, you don't fit on this improv team, you know, whatever, it's your attitude
yeah.
or blah, blah, blah.
It's never going to feel good.
It's never going to feel good. And I don't even know if I completely suggest that. I do think, though, if you're on a team where like six people, like if you're on a team with six people who feel the same way, one person's ruining it and it's ruining it for you, you might be better off leaving that team. You know, leave that team. And if the team breaks up, you know, it's just an improv team. You can all break up. You can be, you know, Monsters, Inc., INK on Tuesday and then break up and then six of you get back together as Farmers Only on Wednesday. You know? You don't need to, like, worry about, like, oh, no, do we got to take down the sign? You know, what about our website? You know?
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Like, I've seen a couple of people who are like, yeah, like, yeah, we were on a team together, and then, like, four of them, we all broke up, we agreed to break up, and then four of them got back together without me. Well, guess what? Then it's time for you to just kind of think about yourself as a player
yeah.
at that point.
Find who fits you.
Yeah.
I remember back when I was starting improv, I saw Boy Butter do a set, and you guys were such a well-oiled machine. I remember, like, you guys were one of my favorite teams mm-hmm. because you had such an incredible group mind. And yeah, I do remember you guys taking risks. Like, you made such bold choices and had such big characters. Did you guys hang out outside of practices?
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's that thing of, like, there are teams where, like, you know, you don't hang out because you don't share a sense of humor and you immediately get on each other's nerves. But a team where you can hang out and you are having fun, you just bring that on stage, you know? And you
yeah.
like, and you enjoy everything about your improv. So you talk about it. You're like, remember that scene, blah, blah, blah? Remember that scene? Oh, yeah. Like, you're just kind of so excited about your shows and you're so excited to get on stage.
Yeah.
I think that was another thing that Boy Butter, we're also very serious about improv, at least at the time. Mm. I mean, now I think, you know, well, I think at the end of the day, there are five players made it onto Harold Knight, you know, so.
Yeah, a lot of heavy hitters mm-hmm. on that team.
So we all kind of cared a lot and we're very serious about getting good. So that will always trump anything else. But again, after that, you know, it's just like people who share a sense of humor you know, we're self-aware and all want to be in comedy. I think everybody, like, in some way or the other is in doing, like, you know, media or comedy. I mean, that's everybody, like,
yeah.
But, like, still, we really were like, yeah, we all want to do comedy.
I know you are particularly good at characters. Whenever I see you do a set, there's always a great Alexis character.
Thank you.
Do you have a favorite you like to play?
You know, I just think that I kind of love it when we get to a very distinct point of view and just I can just like snap into that point of view and just go from it, you know, go for it. Like the like Last Harold Knight, there was like a scientist in the opening, we're talking about a scientist who just like loved to prank people. And I just was like, yeah, I can be that guy forever. I just love that. Just like, not, you know, I think that, you know, in general, maybe like what I bring on stage as myself is somebody who's just defiant, you know. So I just love defiant characters who are just also really silly.
Yeah. You're great at playing them.
No, thank you.
Is there a question you wish I would ask you?
Well, I don't.
I'm sorry, that's such a weird question.
No, I don't think so. I think all your questions were pretty great.
That's so kind of you. Yeah. I've been so nervous being a host. I didn't want to say.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Is there anything people can look out for, what you're doing next?
So you can check me out in Some Kid on Harold Knight. 50-50 is a monthly show where we do half Spanish, half English improv. And Living Room has spots, you know, every now and then at UCB. And that's also a fun show. And that's about it. I mean, I'm also like one of the like reporters every now and then on the President Show. You could check that out.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, you were a joy to talk to. I wish
you were a joy to talk to.
I wish we could expand this into like 4 hours. I have so much I want to talk to you about.
All right, thank you.
Well, and that was a long form conversation. Tune in to the next episode where Alexis will change seats and he will be the host.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting-edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at ucbtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.